This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Keith O'Brien, author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. We look at the true story of pioneering women aviators. In the news, we look at Air Canada's near disaster last year. The FAA approves an ultralight VTOL, FAA reauthorization, perhaps our longest running topic, an F-35B crash, and an American Airlines podcast. We also hear more from the 2018 Dorkfest event in a visit with the Collings Foundation. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 523 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was a CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Well, hello.
That's it? That's all you've got, huh?
Well, I don't want to hog the show here.
All right. Okay. Our other co-host, you threw me there. I was waiting. Our other co-host is David Vanderhoof. He's our resident aviation historian and man of knowledge when it comes to military aviation. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. I have to give a shout out to my new friend and podcaster. We'll just call her C. She thinks I'm old, and she doesn't believe that I actually do this as a hobby. So I'm going to just say, hi, C, and I look forward to hearing your response when you hear this. Oh. So it's not often I do something like that, but in this case, it needs to be done.
That sounds like you've just accumulated a lot of brownie points. Good for you, David.
Well, I hope it turns into brownie points, like brownies, like chocolate or chocolate chip or
yummy
snickerdoodles.
All right. Well, let's introduce our guest for this episode. That's Keith O'Brien. He's author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Well, Fly Girls is the true story of women flyers in the 20s and 30s who were really willing to risk everything, including even their lives, to do what it was that they loved, to fly. They had many defeats, but despite that, these women fought to change the world, to shatter the glass ceiling and battle injustice. As for Keith, he's a former reporter for the Boston Globe, a frequent contributor to National Public Radio, NPR. His work has appeared on shows such as All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and This American Life. He's also written for the New York Times Magazine, Politico, and Slate. So, Keith, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Now, this is going to be a very interesting topic because it kind of blends a lot of things. I think it kind of blends, well, history, aviation history, how women were treated in the past, maybe even treated these days to a certain degree. And it's all wrapped around a great aviation story. So we're going to jump right in with that and start with our main topic. So is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
All right. Well, Keith, one of the things that really stood out to me as I was reading the book is the degree to which flying, aviation, was capturing, I guess, the imagination of so many people. When you talk about the air races, the air derbies, you know, all of these kinds of events where folks were demonstrating, flying, competing in their early century airplanes, the size of the crowds was just often amazing to me. What was it that captured everybody's interest in the 20s and 30s?
So, you know, we have to recast our minds and think back to this different time. You know, we take flying for granted today. Most people do anyway. But at the time, when my story begins in 1927, there's just real magic in aviation. You know, most people have never been in a plane. People who are seeing them race are sometimes seeing planes flying at this kind of speed for the very first time. So it's something brand new, and it really is capturing our imagination. I think the closest thing to compare it to would be the moon race of the 1960s. Mm. You know, at the beginning of the 1960s, many people believed we would never make it to the moon. Many experts believed we would never make it to the moon. There were similar doubts about aviation in the late 1920s. Many people, including aviation experts, believed we would never be able to fly nonstop from New York to Paris, that it was just too far. And, you know, it was so in doubt that in the late 1920s, before Lindbergh makes this flight in May of 1927, aviation engineers are writing articles for magazines about how we could maybe build a floating platform in the middle of the North Atlantic where you could land, refuel, and take off again. So there's a lot of doubt. There's also a lot of magic in the idea that that you could fly. And so, of course, these air races, which were real races, you know, with winners and losers and, you know, big jackpots of money for the victors, it drew incredible crowds. And you mentioned at the outset, Max, I mean, we're talking about 125,000 paying customers in a single day. Just as many would watch for free on the hoods of their automobiles parked on nearby highways. 500,000 people in a single weekend. I mean, this was really sort of the Super Bowl of its day.
It's quite spectacular. I mean, just to envision that number of spectators is, it's almost hard to believe. But of course, it was dangerous too at that time. And so at a lot of these events, people saw crashes and even fatalities.
They did. You know, inevitably, pilots flying in the beginning anyway, open cockpit, single propeller planes would crash, and they would sometimes die right in front of the grandstand. And that, you know, the next thing that would happen was what really blew my mind. You know, of course you would crash and maybe die in these races. You're flying 220 miles an hour, 75 feet off the ground, whipping your plane around pylons, you know, on this course, in a triangular course. Of course, things were going to happen. Things were going to go wrong. But what was so amazing to me is the races would go on. They would not stop the races even if someone died. The very next race would take off, and the races would continue the next day. People just plowed ahead.
Hmm. And of course, almost all of the pilots were men, but there were some women out there capable of flying and wanted to fly, but they really weren't viewed the same way as the men were.
They weren't. So, you know, the first modern air races took place in 1928. These events have been happening for a number of years, but it's really 1928 where everything changes. A used car salesman by the name of Cliff Henderson puts them on in a bean and barley field south of downtown Los Angeles. Today we know this field by three letters. It's LAX.
Right.
The future site of LAX is where they hold the air races of 1928. And they're so popular and so big that the women want in, you know, and of course they would. You know, air racing by the end of 1928 is one of the most popular sports in America. It's baseball, it's boxing, it's air racing. And so the women begin to lobby to be included. And they win inclusion in 1929, but it's on the men's terms. You know, the men initially are willing to accept the women, but they want to do it on their own terms. And the terms initially are these. The women want to fly in a transcontinental air derby from Santa Monica to Cleveland. And the men are excited about this. Cliff Henderson, the used car salesman, who's now the head of the air races, is excited about them. You know, he knows if Amelia Earhart and Louise Thaden and some of these other big female aviators of the day are racing, it's going to bring headlines. But initially try to impose two rules upon the women. Number one, they want them to fly accompanied by a man. And number two, they don't want them flying across the Rocky Mountains. The air race organizers are concerned, they say, about the stamina of the women. That's their word. So they want them to fly from like Omaha to Cleveland for the races. Amelia Earhart, Louise Thaden, Ruth Nichols, some of the other key women at the heart of my book refuse, and they vow to boycott. And they ultimately win the right to race all the way from Santa Monica to Cleveland. But the men do impose upon them certain rules that the men themselves never faced. They mandate that the women stop in 15 different places along the way. And Amelia Earhart and the other women accept these rules because they know it's the only way they're going to fly. They're going to compete. But it sort of backfires on the men because by the time the women reach Cleveland 8 days later, the American newspapers have been filled with dispatches of their adventures and their mishaps, and at times even one of their deaths for the past week. And so when the women get to Cleveland, they are some of the most famous aviators in America. And, you know, this is really where the next fight begins. You know, the women will soon want to race the men. The men won't allow it. They ultimately will allow it. Then they'll banish the women. It's a bitter feud back and forth that goes on for years.
And that first event, that derby from Santa Monica to Cleveland, it wasn't officially called the Powder Puff Derby, right? But that's sort of a name that the press somehow latched onto. And it's kind of indicative of, you know, I mean, how these women were viewed.
It is, you know, that term Powder Puff is still with us today. You know, if you go to a college campus, you know, the women's, you know, football league might be called the Powder Puff League. And it's important to point out, you know, that this wasn't intended to be a compliment. You know, this was a denigrating nickname.
Right.
You know, the official name of the race, it was the Women's National Air Derby. You know, that's what it was called. But by day two, on this journey across the country, the newspaper reporters, all men, you know, begin to slip this different term in. They call it the Powder Puff Derby, and it is a reference to a popular, you know, makeup application of the day. You know, the Powder Puff, and you know, it is not intended as a way to praise the women. It's a classic way that the men, the male pilots, and indeed the male reporters consistently and regularly tried to knock the women down.
Now, you describe some occurrences along the way, maybe even sabotage, some strange things happening with some of the women's airplanes at different stops. Did they ever really pin down whether that was sabotage?
They did not. So yes, by day two of this race, several women are complaining that their planes have been tampered with, that they have returned to the field in the morning to find their plane in a different state in which they left it the night before. And on that next day's trip, many women have problems with their plane. You know, one notably has gasoline put in her oil tank instead of the other way around. Another woman complains that her brace wires connecting her wings to the fuselage of her plane snap in mid-flight as if they had been cut by pliers. None of it's ever proven. But to me, the bigger takeaway of this race is really how the women were treated once something went wrong. You know, one of these women will die in this Transcontinental Air Derby. Her plane will go down in the desert east of Phoenix, and she will die in a creek bed there for reasons that are never ultimately known. It's important to point out that many men would die in these air races too. And when they did, when these men died, they were often hailed as heroes and given tributes on the airfield, you know, with 21-gun salutes and flybys and at times even their ashes scattered from a plane while everybody, you know, held their hats over their hearts. When a woman died in the races, as happened in 1929. There were no tributes. There were no plaudits of these women being heroines. They were typically blamed for the death, for dying. And that's what happened in 1929. As soon as one of these women dies in this race, here are the critics coming out of the woodwork to complain about the women, to blame them for failing. And the women themselves, I think, in the most telling detail, they knew this was going to happen. You know, before they left Santa Monica, Louise Thaden, who was one of the most accomplished female aviators of her time and really Amelia Earhart's best friend, Louise Thaden told the other women, you know, she said, "We need to be 100% perfect. You know, all of us need to get to Cleveland." You know, they knew that they were all connected to each other, at least in the minds of the men, you know, for good or for ill.
Hmm. Yeah, and the advice there that Louise gave, I mean, it almost rings true in modern times too. In the present day, you hear that quite often with women or minorities or some group of individuals who are trying to break through and join the society as or their employment as equals to the rest are kind of under the gun, if you will. They're pressured into having to perform flawlessly. So, I mean, we hear it even today.
I mean, sadly, I believe you are right. You know, I began my research on this book in the late spring of 2016. You know, this is, you know, we were in a different time and place then. You know, Hillary Clinton was leading in the polls. There was no Me Too movement. You know, this book was born out of my love for this narrative and for these characters who had been forgotten. But sadly, there are a great many echoes in the struggle of these characters today. Sadly, you know, the fight that these women fought 85 years ago is still happening right now.
Mm. And it was a pretty diverse group of women, the five that you kind of focus on the most. They are kind of a total cross-section of economic status, social status. It's a very broad spectrum.
Yeah, you know, and I want to be clear, you know, to your listeners, you know, this isn't intended to be a comprehensive history of women in aviation in the 1920s and 30s, where each woman has her own chapter. That is not this book. You know, this is one specific narrative of women fighting for the right to fly and the right to race. It is really the story of a group of friends. You know, these women were rivals in the sky at times, you know, fighting for the same attention, for the same prizes, for the same historic flights. But they were friends. And, you know, the sort of friends who, when they crashed, and they all did crash, even Amelia, that these friends would be at one another's bedside, you know, would be there to console them, would be there, you know, until the end. It really is the story of a group of friends.
Mm, yeah, as I recall, during the Derby, the Santa Monica to Cleveland race, that one of the women, I forget which one, kind of did a nose plant, was it, in her airplane, bent the propeller?
Yeah, it was Amelia.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She seemed to crash kind of a lot compared to some of the others, but she was out there in the desert at a stop there where they were all stopping. And of course, the way the Derby worked, for those of you listening, is that they were racing against the clock. So as they were flying from one location to the next, each was timed, and each of the women, their total time for the entire distance determined, you know, the winner. And when Amelia bent her propeller like that, the others said that they would wait for the replacement. Is that right, Keith?
That's correct. Yeah, they were in Yuma. They were in Yuma, Arizona, and she had bent her propeller upon landing in this sandy this sandbox really of an airstrip, and she needed to have a new propeller flown in from San Diego, and the other women all agreed to wait until the propeller got there.
Hmm. Now, before that race, kind of the big milestone event, I guess, was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic. And, you know, you describe the attempts by many to do that. But the thing that really caught my attention was that the goal, it seemed like it was for a woman to fly, not necessarily to pilot an airplane across the Atlantic, but to be in an airplane that crossed the Atlantic. Because even just as a passenger, women were not expected to be able to withstand the, you know, the rigors of flight of that duration.
Right. Isn't that a crazy thing? You know, we've all sort of learned this reductive history about Amelia Earhart, and even me, you know, before I started this project, you know, I assumed, you know, when Amelia flew solo across the Atlantic, that was the first time she did it. And that was that. And it's just a much more complex and complicated story than that, that begins in the summer of 1927, just a few months after Lindbergh has flown the Atlantic. You know, women now want to be the first of their gender to fly across the ocean. And there will be a race, you know, in the fall of 1927, of a couple American women in particular trying to get across the ocean. One of them is not going to do any flying at all. She's going to, sort of organize a crew, and the other one is going to do flying, going to be a co-pilot on this flight, is an actual pilot, but neither of them are named Amelia Earhart. And you know, it's only, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything here for your listeners, it's of course only because these women fail in the fall of 27 that it opens the door for Amelia Earhart. But as you pointed out, you know, when she goes in the spring of 28, she is a licensed pilot. She's been licensed for 7 years. But by her own admission at that time, she's not doing much flying anymore. She is a social worker in Boston. She's working at a settlement house in Boston's Chinatown, teaching new immigrants to this country how to speak English and how to get jobs. And it is here in Boston that she is discovered, essentially, you know, plucked from obscurity by wealthy men, including her future husband, publisher George Putnam, to be a passenger on a plane flown by men across the ocean. And it is for this flight in June of 1928 that Amelia Earhart becomes a household name, becomes famous. But, you know, to her enduring credit, she knows that what she has done on this flight is really nothing. You know, as she will say to someone that summer, you know, I was just cargo on that flight. I was a sack of potatoes. And she will spend the rest of what will be a very short life, just 9 more years. That's how long she's in the spotlight, just 9 years, making daring flights as an answer to her critics, because Amelia Earhart did have critics.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I guess mainly by men who felt threatened, I suppose, by what she was accomplishing. Some things are supposed to be manly and, you know, and all of that. Of course, we usually view those things differently now, not in all cases. But the inspiration for you that started the journey, your journey that resulted in this book, I guess, is it true that it actually started on an airplane flight that you were on?
It is. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. I was flying from Boston to Pittsburgh. In June, early June night of 2016, for a story I was doing at the time for Politico magazine. It was a JetBlue flight, and for the flight I grabbed a book that had been sitting on my bedside stand for some time. It was Lily Koppel's The Astronaut Wives Club, which is a narrative nonfiction about the wives of the first 7 astronauts. You know, one of my favorite books of all time is The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, which, of course, is about the 7 astronauts. And I really wanted to read Lily Koppel's book just to see how she had done it. and how she had brought this story to life from a different perspective. And early in the book, and there was just some background, historical background, and there was one line about that all women's air race in 1929, this race that had featured Amelia Earhart. And the line just stopped me because I had never heard of such a thing. You know, unlike you and maybe many of your listeners, you know, I am not an aviator. I'm not an aviation geek. I'm not an aviation historian. I'm a journalist and a storyteller. And it just jumped out at me because I had never heard of Amelia Earhart competing in a race. And so I just sort of did what a journalist does. You know, I just pulled the string, you know, and followed it. And when I did, this whole world just revealed itself.
Doing the research for the book, was it difficult, or is the historic record pretty complete?
It was very difficult. You know, so newspapers and radio, of course, covered the air races and all the characters who competed in them, like we cover the NFL today. So the newspapers are filled with accounts and stories and at times dialogue and quotes. But you can't build a narrative on just that. You know, I wanted internal hopes, internal thoughts, and their dreams and fears. And for that, you really do need archives, because all of these characters have been dead for at least 40 years, and in some cases much longer than that. So I can't go interview them. And so I really did have to dig up the archives for these women. You know, for Amelia Earhart, it was rather easy to find. You know, her archives are well known and they're voluminous. They're primarily at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and at Purdue University in Indiana. But for the other women, it was much more difficult to find their papers, their memos, their telegrams, their diaries. But you know, I ultimately did for all of these women. And at times, you know, got very lucky in how I found them. You know, I tracked down distant relatives who unearthed at times unpublished memoirs out of boxes in their attics, literally. And also, you know, really got lucky in finding some of their archives. You know, Ruth Nichols, for example. She was, by 1931, just objectively speaking, the most accomplished female aviator in this country. She had eclipsed Amelia Earhart. You know, she had the speed record and the transcontinental speed record and the altitude record. And it is Ruth Nichols who will set off trying to fly solo across the ocean, you know, 1 year before Amelia will. So she's a very big deal, very famous, and she lives for a long time. So she was the kind of person who would have left her papers somewhere, and I could not find them. You know, they were not in any of the usual places. Early in this process, I visited a small lakefront airport in Cleveland, and at this airport, there's a small museum there called the International Women's Air and Space Museum. It's quite small, just two staffers, and I went there for a few days, and I asked for all the material they had on about a dozen different people. And they brought the stuff out. And when I got to Ruth Nichols, there was really nothing more than what I already had. They had basically just newspaper articles. So I left disappointed. And I went back to New Hampshire and I did, you know, what any great researcher would do next. I just started Googling it.
Sure, yeah.
I just started Googling Ruth Nichols a million different ways. And finally, I found this PDF, which was a finding aid for her papers at the same little museum in Cleveland. So I called them back and they went to the back room and storage and they found, you know, this wall of file cabinets that were just lost there in the clutter. And it was there in this little lakefront airport in Cleveland that I knew I would be able to bring Ruth Nichols back to life on the pages of the book.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's a detective process to discover, I think, these things, and also to really get at the real heart of the subjects of the women, because as we've discussed, the, you know, newspaper accounts, published accounts are oftentimes colored from a certain perspective. And to really understand these women themselves, it's more difficult than just reading the newspaper stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm curious, Keith. I think I read in the 1929 race that there were 20 women who were involved in it. Now, you focused on five women. How did you choose those five?
So as a journalist, I believe that you should be able to tell people what your story is about in two lines or less. And if you know what your story is about, if you really can say it, then you know what you're looking for and you know who your character should be. In this case, it's a little bit trickier, you know, because as I mentioned earlier, if you were going to do a historical book where each woman had her own chapter, you'd need 30 chapters or 25 chapters. There were a lot of brave, bold women who were flying planes in this time. But, you know, I chose these women because they are fundamental to the story. You know, Amelia Earhart, Louise Thaden, and Ruth Nichols were three prominent flyers of their day who really were at the heart and soul of the fight to win the right to fly, to win the right to race. And also they were friends, close friends. And then, you know, you've got Ruth Elder, who in 1927, you know, in the summer of 1927, decides she's going to be the first woman to fly across the ocean. It is, you know, a dream for which Ruth Elder will really pay an awful price. But she proves, you know, to the world that a woman with a bold plan and a capable plane is very difficult to ignore. And she opens the door for Amelia Earhart. And then the last character here is Florence Klingensmith. And really, you know, Florence is not well known. She has been almost completely erased from history. But in 1933, she was, again, just objectively one of the most accomplished female aviators in this country, one of the best female air racers in this country. And, you know, she is chosen to fly against the men in a real sort of, you know, precursor to the Billie Jean King Battle of the Sexes. You know, Florence Klingensmith will fly against the men in Chicago. And, you know, when I stumbled upon that story, Florence and her story and what happens in Chicago, that's really when I knew I had something here, because what happens to Florence in Chicago is really the Velcro of this narrative. It changes everything for both the women in the sky and on the ground.
So how you're on a tour right now, a national book tour. How are people responding to the book? What kinds of people are you finding that are attracted to the book?
It's people of all stripes, across the board. It's really a cross section of our country, but of course, there have been a number of pilots at all of my events, and it's been really gratifying, in particular, to meet over the course of this tour a great many female pilots who are flying today. Some of the folks I've met have been flying with airlines. Many of them are private pilots. And you know, what's been really just one of the most gratifying things is just hearing their stories. You know, women today, sadly, you know, are still fighting for representation in aviation, in the sky, and they still face, you know, a great many challenges. I know that because I've now met so many who've shared their stories with me. But the coolest thing has been, you know, meeting women in particular who have told me that they just started to learn to fly a few years ago, and here they are in their 50s, or here they are in their, you know, late 40s, and they decided they wanted to do it, and they are doing it, and they are flying. And as most of your listeners will know, you know, if you love flying, it's just something that's inside of you. It's like people who love the sea or love sailing. You know, if you love it, it's part of you and you can't let it go. And that's a universal feeling for pilots, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're black or white or straight or gay, it doesn't matter. If you love flying, you just love it.
Well, Keith, we've only touched on a few of the major points from the book, but we need to leave something for our listeners to read. But I would comment that it's It's a very interesting book from a number of different perspectives. One, I think it's a very, well, the writing style, I think, is very easy and very comfortable. It keeps you engaged. You learn a lot, or I learned a lot along the way about history, important aspects of aviation history that I wasn't familiar with. So from that standpoint, I would certainly recommend it to anyone who's interested in aviation, the Av Geeks, of course. And then there's another view of it, which is just the role of women and how they've been perceived and treated, and difficulties that they've had to endure. And I think I said before, but as you look at that from the standpoint of aviation, your mind just races ahead to what's happening around us today. And while we like to think, at least maybe men, that we've made an awful lot of progress, it really kind of drives home the point that there's an awful lot of progress that still needs to be made. So enjoyable book all around that really achieves a lot of different things. So I think that's great. Where should folks go to find the book? Probably all the usual places where fine books are sold.
You can get the book anywhere books are sold. Your local bookseller, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and if you'd like to learn more, there's also a website for the book. It's very simple, flygirlsbook.com. Again, flygirlsbook.com. There's a photo gallery there, some background about the characters, also a really cool video trailer for the book that uses old film footage from these air races that really brings these women back to life.
And if folks want to follow you on Twitter, they can find you there, can't they?
You can. I'm on Twitter at Keith OB.
Very good. All right. Keith O'Brien, author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Keith, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, as we record this episode on October 1st, this is a really significant anniversary. David, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I have to admit that I was reminded by our favorite NASA historian and my hero, Bill. He sent us an email today. October 1st, 1958, which was 60 years ago today, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration came into existence. Built largely on the basis of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, or NACA, NASA included parts of the U.S. Navy, the Vanguard folks from the Naval Research Laboratory, and parts of the U.S. Army, the Von Braun team for the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, then an Army contractor. As our first NASA administrator said in his message to his employees, quote, "We got a mighty big job to do." 60 years later, NASA employees look back and are inspired by the accomplishments of those who've gone before us. We've still got a, quote, mighty big job to do, and we are dedicated to making sure that 60 years from now, NASA staff working on Earth, the Moon, Mars, and wherever else it may be in the solar system will be similarly inspired by our efforts. Bill sent some links in the show notes for their NASA 60 in 60 seconds video and some of the other stuff going on. But thanks to Bill for that reminder. I know the next year will be quite celebratory because we're getting ready for the, believe it or not, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, which is next year, Apollo 11. In other feedback, Bill saw The First Man, I think it's what it's called, the new movie about Neil Armstrong, and highly recommended it.
Oh, really?
So definitely, if you get a chance, evidently go see it. He was very pleased with it. We were going back and forth because, you know, I won't go see it if he tells me it's low, and he's the expert. So that's my what we did this week with the geeks. I cheated, but thanks, Bill, for the correspondence. And just remember, it's theuavdigest.com.
All right. And as David says, we'll have some links to the NASA video and some other information in the show notes. So look for that at airplanegeeks.com/523. Now, as you know, we often have an airline story of the week, but this week we have, I guess this is a ridiculous airline story of the week.
This is from our favorite airline. The title, this comes, by the way, from businessinsider.com. The title is, United Airlines is under fire after a flight attendant reportedly told a mother her baby wasn't allowed to cry for more than 5 minutes. Now, I...
I think that's a good rule.
We probably don't.
Yeah. No, I'm going to get in trouble for that.
Well, it's a good rule.
It's a great rule, but it's a very impractical one.
Sure. Yeah,
I mean, and who came up with 5 minutes? I mean, it's just absurd. Anyway, it was a United Airlines flight 870 from Sydney to San Francisco. It was just last Monday, September the 24th. And after takeoff, while sitting in their business class seats, the young child started to cry. The flight attendant said that it was absolutely unacceptable for the baby to cry. And this was, of course, documented on the Facebook page. The flight attendant actually took the mother back to economy class after offering a lecture on parenting, in which she was told, quote, babies are not allowed to cry for more than 5 minutes, and, quote, that it really stressed the crew out. Now, I think that might be more to the point here of this story. It sounds to me like someone didn't get enough sleep before she reported for duty that day. So, you know, what can I say? Everybody has a bad day, and I think this probably speaks more toward the flight attendants, you know, probably, you know, not being fully prepared for the job that day. Probably needed a little bit more sleep.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Yeah, I mean, we all have tough days. I know if I don't get enough sleep, then I'm a little more cranky the next day. And yeah, this sounds cranky to me.
I always get accused of being grumpy in the morning. But if I was flying nonstop Australia to LAX on a regular basis, yeah, I think I would be grumpy too.
All right. Well, Max, you're headed out for an AOPA regional fly-in coming up. Is that your next adventure? Yeah.
It's true. Later this week, I will be headed out to Carbondale, Illinois, where coincidentally I was there just about a year ago for the solar eclipse. I'll been to Carbondale twice in about 13 months, and I'll be giving a 3-hour presentation on behalf of AOPA on advanced IFR techniques. So anybody who's going to be in the Carbondale area, come on out. And also just want to mention that this week on the Aviation News Talk podcast, I've got listener feedback. And I'm going to put together all that feedback on things that their flight instructors didn't teach them as student pilots that they had to figure out on their own later as private pilots. So that's the 20 things your CFI didn't teach you. So it should be a fun show on Aviation News Talk.
Yeah, I'm listening to your previous episode right now. I'm through the front part. I think I'm right up to the part where you're going to start talking about your experiences with the Cirrus Vision Jet. So I'm really excited to hear what you've got to say about that adventure.
And Max, I need to talk to you because, you know, it is not too late to get your private pilot's license.
It's never too late.
No, it's we gotta get you started working on that.
All right, we'll see. All right, well, we've got some more recordings from Brian. We talked about last time, he attended the Dorkfest 2018 event, plane spotting and camaraderie at LAX. That's, of course, hosted by Brett Snyder of Cranky Flyer. Boy, you know, it's been a long time since we've had Brett on the show. Maybe we should correct that.
I think the last time we had him, he just started Cranky Concierge.
Yeah, I think that would have been years ago. Yeah.
Well, Brett, if you're hearing us, we need you to report to the microphone as soon as possible.
Yes. All right. So Brian's got three recordings, and let's start off with the first one. I think this is with Brett.
I finally been able to track down the organizer of the show, Brett Snyder.
I'm here. It's tough. Everyone wants to talk shop. It's so much fun, you know.
And then we have planes flying. Okay, I got the Disney theme.
Beautiful.
Who was that?
Alaska, right?
Was it Alaska?
Isn't that their plane?
I couldn't tell.
I think it's Alaska.
So, hey, Brett, thank you so much for putting together Dorkfest. This looks like it was the best well-attended event so far.
Yeah, there were a ton of people here. You know, last year I think we had about 75. This year I would be surprised if it was fewer than 100. But I have, since everyone fills out their names for the raffle, I'll just go count them at the end of the day and get an idea of how many people were here.
And then there were, you certainly got a couple of contributions for the swag as well, so that was great.
It's ridiculous how much swag we ended up having here. I mean, what was that, maybe 10 models, and then the free tickets from Spirit, which was amazing, and then, of course, United giving out the window panel from the 747. That was a highlight, but an American with the Admirals Club, five-star service, flagship dining, that was crazy. There's
yeah,
that was
really disappointing that I didn't win any, or you pulled my name and selected me out. I'm not sure.
No, I didn't pick. I let Ben do the picking for me there, but I thought, I mean, there was just so much stuff. It was great, but sorry, maybe next year you'll have to come back.
What made you decide to set this up as an event?
Well, that's the thing. It's not an event, right? Because,
well,
but that's why, because I live here. I mean, I live in Long Beach, and on a Saturday, it's easy to get up here. It's 20 minutes for me, and I do this anyway. I'll bring my kids out, and we'll watch airplanes. So
right.
I do this. We just hang out and watch airplanes, and I just invite everyone. And I put it on the blog, and I said, hey, I'm going to just go watch airplanes. Why don't anyone come out, and we can talk about it. And they did. They just keep coming. So.
And so if any of our listeners aren't familiar with the blog, and they definitely should be, where can they go to get it?
Crankyflyer.com, F-L-I-E-R.
And then the other service they have, the Cranky Concierge, how's that going?
That's been great. We have about 15 people now in the company.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, we do everything from helping people with booking flights, miles or money, to monitoring when they're traveling and helping when things go wrong. And so, you know, we do small business travel. We do all kinds of stuff. So it's good.
Yeah, it's probably been, what, about 2 years since we had you on the show. We should probably get you back on and give our listeners an update.
Yeah, it's a good question. I wonder, I'm trying to remember when it was.
It was right when Cranky Concierge first won. So
no, because that was 9 years ago that I did that. It hasn't been that long. There's definitely since then.
All right, I'll cut that.
Yeah, this is, It's definitely been sooner than that, but I don't remember exactly when.
Well, that's pretty fantastic. They have 15 people helping flyers around the world with their travel-related issues.
Yeah, it's grown well. We're not growing too fast, but, you know, over 9 years to get to this point, it's been pretty good, and we're growing more, so it's going well.
Any other announcements that you can make as far as what you're doing, or just slow and steady with what you have?
Yeah, I don't really have any other announcements. I mean, I always think about, you know, the concierge business is one thing, but I always think about what can I do with the blog more. You know, events like this are fun, but, you know, there are only so many times you can do this, I guess. But so, you know, if anyone has suggestions, send them over, things you'd like to see me arrange or do.
Yeah,
I'm all ears.
The in-depth analysis that you do on any particular subject, I think there's a lot of value in that. And that's certainly why I continue to read the blog. And every once in a while you write something that I don't particularly agree with. But
well, that's fine.
But that's okay, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
disagreement's part of the fun. I mean, that's, you know, I put up posts that I know that whatever I say is not necessarily going to be something everyone agrees with. I mean, there's nothing everyone agrees with,
exactly.
Right?
No, but again, that's what I enjoy, is having another perspective. And there are certainly things that you've written that have changed my mind about a particular topic because I never looked at it from that angle before. So again, I think you guys are doing a great job in that regard.
Thank you. I think that's part of the thing. I think that's part of what I like to do, is have write from this other perspective. You know, there are things that I may decide I don't actually care about covering, but then I see people writing in a way that I think is just the wrong way to look at it,
mm-hmm.
and then it spurs me to write it because I just think, well, that doesn't seem right to me. Like, this is how I'm looking at it. And, you know, there are going to be people out there who don't care, call you an airline apologist or whatever, which is absurd. The point is, come have a debate about the point, and sometimes I will take the airlines to task. It's not like this is a, you know, I'm not always saying the airlines are doing everything right, but of course I worked in the industry, that's my perspective. There's a lot more I understand about how it works, and so I'll have that perspective sometimes. And, you know, if you disagree, great, come debate it. The comment section is actually pretty lively sometimes.
Yep,
so
that it is. And then every once in a while you get guest writers as well.
Very rarely. I mean, I used to do more of that. I just don't, you know what, here's what it comes down to. There are other blogs I read where they add contributors later, and I just don't like it. It just, you know, I tend to want that person's unique voice, and that's why I go to the blog, and I don't care about the volume of posts.
Right.
And so, since I don't like it, I just don't want to do the same thing that I've seen others do as well. So, that's just kind of how I end up approaching that stuff.
And it's your site, and you could do whatever you
want. Yeah, exactly, right. I'm not, that's the other thing about it. You know, a lot of these sites, they're trying to pump up the page views, or do a bunch of stuff here to you know, just try and get more ad revenue or whatever it might be. And I don't ever really look at it that way, so, yeah, I don't really care. Yeah. I do what I want.
No, awesome. Definitely appreciate it. And I truly believe that it's a valuable service that you're adding to the industry, so thank you so much for doing what you do.
Well, thanks for saying that. That's nice. I appreciate it.
Right, next we have another short recording from Brian, taken at Dorkfest, and this is with Ben from NYC Aviation.
I'm here with Ben, who was on episode 384.
Hi.
And welcome to the show here from Dorkfest.
Hi, how are you?
So far, so good. So can you describe to the listeners what your affiliation participation is in this event?
So I am a senior editor and director for NewYorkCityAviation.com, and for the last 2 years we've coordinated our LAX plane spotting weekend with Brett Snyder and his Cranky Flyer Dorkfest.
Right.
We bring about 30 people in, and we encourage them to attend Dorkfest as well, and we just kind of come and help Brett out in whatever way we can and enjoy the crowd.
And there were certainly a lot more than 30 people who showed up today.
Oh, there sure were. We probably had close to 100 again, which is great.
So what was the best part of the day for you as we're kind of wrapping up here?
You know, it's just, it's good to see the people that I don't see more than maybe.
As we pause for an A380. That's about, what, 200 feet over our heads?
Yeah, if that. Aviation has always been about the people for me. There are people I see here that I don't get to see for the rest of the year. Some of them are really good friends. We just live in different parts of the country. And, you know, it's a great chance to, you know, catch up, if only for, you know, a little bit.
Yeah, I've been really surprised by how many people have actually flown into this event. I was really just expecting people from Southern California.
Yeah, that's what I expected the first year, and then I saw all these people flying in, and I'm like, I'd like to do that someday. And last year, kind of the stars aligned, and so we have, you know, people fly in for our event. We get some locals as well, and then we get, you know, Brett has a lot of people who can non-rev in. Some people who just fly in because they're West Coast.
Right.
And some locals.
So what's new at NYC Aviation?
Well, a few months ago, our longtime founder and president, Phil Derner Jr., departed the organization to pursue a great opportunity in the business aviation world. When he departed, he left the ownership and control of the website to a four-member board of directors, which is myself, Jeremy Dwyer Lindgren, Andrew Marino, who is our longtime project manager, and Ryan Ewing from AirlineGeeks.com.
Okay.
We've spent the summer trying to plot our course forward, plan this event, of course, and keep the great content coming.
What about future events? Is there anything else? Are we going to have to wait a whole nother year before we get together?
We're trying to start some happy hours in locations that our team is based in. We hosted one in New York in June. We're hoping to do one in Florida at some point. Maybe one out here in California. We want to open it up to anybody who works with us.
Right.
You know, we can hope, you know, find a lounge space and just, you know, have a nice after work type greeting. And we're always looking for, we want to expand our Spot LAX brand to other airports. So that's something we're currently exploring.
Okay, great. Where's the best place for people to find out about NYC Aviation?
NYCAviation.com, NYC Aviation on Twitter, NYC Aviation on Instagram, NYC Aviation on Facebook. We have the NYCA AvGeek community on Facebook. It's a great place to go and share articles, share photos. We have our photo hanger on the website. which is another great place to share your photos. I'm at B.L. Granucci.
Pretty much anything NYC Aviation, and yes, we should be able to find you. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And finally, we have one more from Brian. Let's listen to that now.
I'm here with Jeremy, hopefully going to be a new listener to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Jeremy, welcome.
Hey, what's going on, man?
You flew down from San Francisco to attend Dorkfest.
I did.
And what motivated you to do that?
I love just sitting here watching the things land. You meet some interesting people down here, make some new contacts.
How did you initially find out about Dorkfest?
I've been reading Brett's blog for 8 years, something like that, from probably close to the beginning.
Okay.
I don't know. I have no idea how I found it originally.
It just happens.
Yep.
Do you travel a lot for work or personally? Or?
Not for work. We try to personally. You know, we got the great Southwest Companion Pass, so It makes it cheap and easy. A lot of intercal flying.
Okay.
Yep.
Are you surprised at the turnout here? Or is this the first one that you...
Second one. I came down here last year, too. And okay. It gets bigger every year. Next year, he's going to have to actually, rent out a spot or something.
Pitch a tent for everyone.
That's right.
Yeah. So what keeps you coming back?
It's an easy flight. Who doesn't want to get on a flight? It's really awesome. Like when the A380 flies overhead, You're that close to it. There's not too many places where you can get this close to them.
Yeah, it feels almost like you could touch it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I ended up convincing you to listen to the show.
I will. I'll check it out for sure.
Awesome. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
And recently, our main man, Micah, visited with the Collings Foundation, and he recorded some conversations there, and we'll play those for you right now. First of all, we'll let Micah introduce the Collings Foundation and what his visit was all about.
Thanks, Max. For me, when I think of the Collings Foundation, I think of the preservation of historic warbirds. I think of history. I think of the beauty and artistry of engineering, and I think of aviation. But mostly, I think of honor. On their website, the Collings Foundation lists two goals for its Wings of Freedom tour. One, to honor the sacrifices made by our veterans that allow us to enjoy our freedom. And two, to educate the visitors, especially younger Americans, about our national history and heritage. When you think about it, there's a unique twist on how the Collings Foundation does this. It's done through what we used to call barnstorming. I'd never quite thought of it that way before, but it makes sense. The Collings Foundation travels from place to place and brings their aircraft to you. For a price, you can tour them, even take a flight in them. That's barnstorming in every sense of the word, but with a higher purpose. The people who work for and fly for the Collings Foundation have a passion for aviation, for flying, and for history. You can hear it in their voices. I found that out when I got to spend a beautiful afternoon this past September visiting with the aircraft they brought to the Portland Jetport and talking with Jamie Mitchell, flight coordinator, Gene Norman, crew chief, and Jonathan Henley, pilot. When you listen to these interviews, pay attention to the enthusiasm for aviation that clearly comes through in their voices.
All right. Micah spoke with Gene Norman. He's crew chief with the Collings Foundation. Here they are.
We're talking with Gene Norman, the crew chief for the Collings Foundation. Gene, thank you so much for coming and speaking with us at the Airplane Geeks. Can you tell us a little bit about what the crew chief position is with the Collings Foundation, what you do?
Well, the crew chief position, mostly concerned with the ground-type operations, the non-flying operations. I book and check in hotels. I pay for fuel. I order supplies. I drive our trailer with the van around the country. And I buy lunches. Just overall, I think of myself as chief cook and bottle washer of this outfit here.
How did you get involved with the Collings Foundation, and how long have you been crew chief?
I started with Collings about 8 years ago as the flight coordinator, and then started crew chiefing in 2013. As far as how I got involved with Collings, pretty much the way that all of us, we're all very sincere enthusiasts for the airplanes and for what we do out here. We all love them. We're all certified wing nuts. So just, you know, by coming out and getting to know the people early on, and, you know, I wound up having an opportunity to come out and start working out here. But we're all just really enthusiastic about being out here. It's a lot of fun.
How would you say that aviation got into your blood?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't remember a time when it wasn't, so I don't really know how to answer that. I don't know. I don't remember. I've loved airplanes as long as I can remember.
That's actually an interesting question. I'd like to know that. Both
of my parents have passed on, but if they were here, I would ask them. I do know that my father and mother used to tell me that I was, even as a toddler, I was interested in airplanes. Just never a time when I wasn't. Yeah.
What are some of the challenges of being a crew chief? What have been some of the most exciting or the most difficult situations that you've been in trying to keep the show on the road?
Well, it's a 7-day-a-week activity, usually for at least 12 hours a day. So it's not for the faint-hearted. Challenges, you know, I mean, just coordinating such a large and diverse group of people. A lot of times, since they are 70-year-old warbirds, a lot of times things happen unexpectedly, like maintenance issues and things like that. There's a lot of coordination that has to go on, and you have to be able to think on the fly to make this whole outfit run. But as I say, you know, we're all big enthusiasts for it, and even though it's a lot of work, you know, it's there's the cool factor never really completely goes away either, so it's really nice.
For those who haven't seen a Collings Foundation presentation or come out to one of the airports to see the Collings Foundation, what would you tell them? Why would the Collings Foundation be an important part of their aviation history career?
I think it's vital history, and I'm concerned that the history is being lost on some of the younger folks. The veterans are all but gone now. There's a few that remain. The ones that are well into their 90s. As recently as when I started with Collings 8 years ago, every stop we went to, there was a handful of veterans, at least 4 or 5 maybe. Now we're seeing 1 and maybe 2. So I just think it's vital history to preserve. And to me, probably one of the best and most unique things about what we do is that it's like a museum, except you're not looking at airplanes behind velvet ropes. You can actually get up close to them, and you can touch them, you can see them, smell them, hear them, and fly on them, of course. You know, we sell flights on the airplanes. It's the airplanes are literally time machines. You know, you get on the airplane, and you're literally in a World War II bomber, and it's pretty hard to imagine anything cooler than that in my book.
Completely agree. And what people sometimes don't realize, and I was fortunate enough to be able to walk through our B-24 that's here today, is that the men that were flying them, and it was men back then that were defending the U.S. at the time, they were kids. Yeah. They were 18, 19, and 20 years old and in that ball turret. And people don't understand how crude it was by comparison to today's generation of aircraft.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they were they had to grow up fast. And, you know, usually the captain of the plane, he might have been in his early 20s. I mean, which, you know, I mean, I'm 53. And when I think of a 22-year-old, I think of a kid. But those guys were not kids. They did their job.
And when you talk to, and I hope to talk to soon, your P-51 pilot, he's about that same age. So it's kind of bringing history back.
Yeah, he's a pretty amazing guy. He's our chief pilot. He's type rated in all of these airplanes out here. I think he started flying when he was in his early teens. And but again, it just goes back to that enthusiasm for the airplanes. I mean, he just absolutely loves them. So it's not really work in that sense. You know, you're just kind of sort of doing what you would do anyway, you know.
Gene, thank you so much for joining us on the Airplane Geeks. We really appreciate it, and we hope to come back and see the Collings Foundation again.
We hope you do.
Micah also spoke with Jamie Mitchell, flight coordinator at the Collings Foundation.
Hey!
We're here at the Portland Jetport, and the Collings Foundation is here. And they're here with a beautiful display of their B-25, their B-24, and their TF-51D. We're talking with Jamie Mitchell, who's the flight coordinator for the Collings Foundation. And Jamie, welcome to the Airplane Geeks, and can you tell us a little bit about what the flight coordinator does?
I pretty much do everything but fly and fix the planes, honestly. So whether it's like PR, media, social media, booking flights, logistics with the airport, the airport authority or the FBO, coordinating stuff with the crew on site, ground crew, whatever it is, I do everything. Every single day, 300 something days straight, 24/7.
So you really run the whole thing.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, the pilots just report to you to find out what they were going to do during the day.
More or less. That's absolutely true.
So, Jamie, how long have you been with the Collings Foundation, and how did you come about working with them?
Actually, I've been with the aircraft. I was hired in December 2015, but I came out on tour in mid-January 2016. I've been out every single day since then. I used to be a geologist in Southern California, and I spent my weekends at Chino Airport, which is my home airport. I was a volunteer at Planes of Fame Air Museum, and I've always been around World War II planes. I always wanted to be a barnstormer and work with these sort of aircraft and never thought it was possible, and this opened up, so I was just going to take off a year and do this, but I've been with it ever since.
It really is kind of addictive, and it's amazing that you were out in Chino and at the Planes of Fame Museum. That's where our associate producer, or former associate producer, Brian Coleman, is from, and he's at the Planes of Fame Museum all the time and raves about it. And in fact, I was supposed to fly out to meet him this weekend that you're here, but then I found out you're here, and I said, I'm not going anywhere if the Collings Foundation is coming to me. Tell me about a little bit about your love of aviation, and where did your love of airplanes come from?
You know, it's hard to describe. There aren't any pilots in my family. I just grew up, you know, close to the World War II planes flying around there. I really liked biplanes, especially if you're familiar with Chapter 1, Flay Bob. All of the old Golden Age air racers are there. I've always kind of been fascinated by those. And I just think it's everybody who's ever flown a biplane, it's their dream to become a barnstormer like Waldo Pepper, or like If You've Seen Nothing by Chance or whatever. That is your ultimate dream as a pilot. And not everybody gets that opportunity to do this for a living. So I dropped everything I've been doing this. I really can't explain why I like airplanes. I'm a glider pilot myself, and I own two gliders, but I'm hoping to be able to fly all these planes someday as well. So whenever they give me a chance to get dual, I always take it. And I'm really excited for a P-40 that we're going to get next year, because that's one of my favorite World War II planes.
The Collings Foundation is getting a P-40 Warhawk. Can you tell us a little bit about that and when she's coming?
Well, we're expecting it anytime in the beginning of the tour next year. It's a full dual-control TP-40 in. We got it not really with the intention to take it on tour, but things kind of worked out how they do. And I'm super excited because I wanted another fighter. So we'll still have the 24, the 25, the 17. We'll still have two loose nuts, RTF-51. But now we'll be adding that second fighter. So it's going to be really awesome. So you'll have the opportunity because, I mean, everybody knows Mustangs. It's probably the most iconic aircraft of the war, and we all love them. But, I mean, there's this special kind of Art Deco sort of thing about P-40s, and I really like them. The first warbird I ever saw fly was a P-40, and so I've been dreaming of this day. And last year I got to go to Australia to see this aircraft being restored, and I cannot wait for it to join the tour. So it'll be sometime early next year.
And what a wonderful aircraft to have with so much history. And again, you're correct. People don't know very much about it, but it's actually where Pappy Boynton got his start, flying for the Chinese government before he ended up in the Marines flying Corsairs. So your title is flight coordinator, and one of the amazing things about the Collings Foundation, it's one of the few places I know where you can actually get a flight on these historic aircraft. How do you arrange for that? I just heard you on the phone talking with people, rescheduling and all that. How does the Collings Foundation arrange to get passengers in aircraft that were certainly never designed for passengers?
Well, I know this whole thing seems like it's just a traveling exhibit, but what really keeps us going are the flights. When people pay to fly on these aircraft, it seems like, oh my goodness, $450, that's a lot of money. But when you consider it costs like, you know, $5,000 or more per flight hour to keep just one of the planes going, it's not that much. So, I mean, we're barnstormers. We're here to fly people. And I think that what I mean to say is, like, you can go to any museum anywhere. You can see a B-17 sitting in a boneyard. You can see a Mustang hanging from the ceiling of someplace. A lot of times you're going to see that. You're going to walk in, walk through, walk out, never remember it. But when you come out here and you get to see it start up, or you get to go over the flight, you get to hear the engine, you get to smell the exhaust, you get to get a little bit of oil in your hands, like, that makes it come to life. You know, that's going to do so much more for you. And it doesn't matter if you're a little kid or if you grew up during the war and you saw these, or if you're a veteran or whatever. What we're doing is so much more than just preserving a plane and having it sit somewhere. We're keeping these planes alive. And when they're alive, the legacy of all those vets that aren't with us is still alive. You know, and I mean, I don't know how to explain that to you, but I have a lot of passion for what I do. I really love these planes. And the only way to keep them flying is to get people to want to go for a flight in them. And I mean, like, I have to say, like, people come out here and they always come out just for the B-17 because they know it from, like, TV shows and movies and whatever. But, I mean, they come back and they don't know what a B-24 is. But they have that great time on the B-17. They go home. They dig through all their dad's stuff. They find out, oh, my goodness, Dad really flew on a B-24. And they come out here and they fly on the B-24 next year. And then it becomes like a tradition. They come back the third year to fly on the B-25. And then they save up for their big one to fly in the Mustang and hopefully even more planes in the future. And it's just, for us, you know, these planes are our family. Like right now, the B-17 is not doing so well, and you know, it's not feeling well. I'm not feeling well. I mean, I'm worried about it. I miss it. I know it's not far away and it's in good hands, but still, you know, I want everybody to be happy and having a good time, and I want all my planes to be healthy. But if people don't come out here and go for flights, we can't afford to keep them flying. And it's just, this is in 29 years that we've been operating, and I want this going for at least another 29 more years. I want you to be able to come out and see a B-24 flying with your own eyes, and as opposed to just the only way you can see it flying is on YouTube or something. I want you to see it in the flesh flying. And, you know, people get to come out here. They can walk through the planes. They can sit in the crew positions. They can talk to our crew if we're really lucky, which we have to be extremely lucky these days. They can talk to a B-24 vet or any vet from the war. We don't have that many left anymore. But you get so much more out of it if you just go for the flight. You know, and I know it's a lot of money. It's hard to give up. But honestly, like, tomorrow is no guarantee, and you definitely can't take it with you. So, I mean, it's worth coming out here and just, you know, give it a try and go for a flight. And I honestly can't recommend anything more than flying in the Mustang, though, because it's my favorite so far.
Your passion comes through just beautifully, and it's completely understood by the airplane geeks. When you say that people might not know what a B-25 or a B-24 is, that's so foreign to me. And just because I grew up with them by talking with my father. And as we were interviewing, we heard two engines. Well, actually, we heard three engines. The first one was a B-25 taking off, and the second one was the P-51 or F-51 taxiing in. And those engines are just music to we airplane geeks, to you and to me. And as a B-25 started up, as it was getting ready to taxi out, and I watched those engines run, and I heard them, and I watched it taxi away, those of us with a passion for that have a tear come to our eye just every time it flies, because it's just such a beautiful thing. And it's marvelous to find someone else who shares that passion and actually works with that passion, and I need to thank you for that.
I'm glad you guys are out here checking out the planes and getting the word out. A lot of people still don't know who we are or what we are. They think we're the commemorative Air Force, so they just don't understand what we're doing. So we got to get more people out here. And you know, right now, a big focus has always been on the veterans, but we don't have so many left. But right now, we really got to think about getting kids out here because, you know, we got to inspire the next generation of pilots and mechanics and restoration people or historians or even ones that are going to join the military. I have a picture on my phone of my chief pilot, who's only 22 right now, but he's maybe 7 or 8 in the picture with RB-17. And, you know, who knows, that day he came out, maybe the person who used to have my job was kind enough to him to take that picture. And, you know, it inspired him to do what he's doing today. I mean, it's really amazing to know that you have the power to inspire and encourage the next generation to care about these, because, you know, right now to kids, it's a video game, it's a movie, it's a couple pages they're forced to study in school, but we can make it so much more. And I want to, if we don't inspire those kids, then this is going to end soon. And so, I don't know, it's just, that's so important to me, which, like, cheesy sort of slogan, we call it giving the past the future. But I mean, honestly, if the kids don't learn to appreciate these and make the connection with the veterans, with the aircraft, you know, then this is not going to go on much longer than I will, you know what I'm saying? So,
Jamie, I thank you very, very much for spending some time with the Airplane Geeks, and have a wonderful day, and best of luck with the Collings Foundation.
Cool. Now, finally, we have Jonathan Henley. He's the P-51 pilot with the Collings Foundation. Boy, there's a job you'd like to have.
We're talking with Jonathan Henley here, who's a pilot for the Collings Foundation, and today you're flying the TF-51D and taking folks for rides. How long have you been flying the TF-51?
Well, the TF-51, it's been almost a year, but I've been flying P-51s for about 2 years now.
And you're a young man. You're probably, I'm guessing by looking at you, and I don't mean to get, you know, weird about that, probably someplace in your 20s. You fly a lot of different aircraft. How did you get involved in aviation, and especially with warbirds?
Well, I was definitely given a pretty good shot early on. I mean, I grew up in warbirds and was able to fly T-6s at a young age. I mean, I started flying the T-6 when I was 17, got a lot of hours doing that, which is kind of the prerequisite for Mustangs. And then my dad, he was doing air shows. He's part of the Aeroshell aerobatic team, matter of fact. And going to air shows, being around warbirds, I was able to get several different flight experiences. And lucky for me is that I grew up around a Mustang. We actually have a third partnership in one, and it was restored in 2015, but then painted in 2016. And then that's when I got to start flying my Mustangs. And I was already volunteering with the Collings Foundation. Once I got my instructor rating and all that, I started coming out here and teaching people how to fly a Mustang.
So you fly both the regular single-seat Mustang and the TF-51, which is a trainer and a two-seat version. What are the big differences between the two that you find?
Well, really, it's just the cockpit and the canopy. I mean, it's when they converted them over to the TF, that's really all they did. Everything below the canopy is still a D model Mustang, and it still feels the same on the controls, same power settings, same numbers as far as speed whenever I'm doing any kind of acro or just maneuvers in general. Same numbers when I cross over the numbers when I come in to land. It's very much just the same airplane. It's just that you're able to teach somebody how to fly it at that point.
Now, one of the amazing and perhaps most wonderful thing about the Collings Foundation is that people can actually fly in these wonderful warbirds. So you're taking people up in this aircraft who would never have had the opportunity before. They may not be pilots. They may not have even ever flown before. They may be pilots that, I guess, hard to find some of them now, that flew the Mustang in their past life, and they're getting back into it for the first time forever. What kind of reactions do you get when you're flying people?
I mean, I would probably say the most common is just awe and amazement, because a lot of these, especially when we get some of the younger crowd out here, you know, they've never seen these before. And even some people who grew up in that era, they haven't really had a chance to be around them either. And then they're in awe just because of how amazing that these airplanes just sound, what they look like, the feel of them. And then those who are pilots that we have come around, they are just, you know, they're the greatest generation for a reason. I mean, they're just so great to work with and get to fly with, and it's just awesome to be able to be a part of such a proud heritage whenever we get to do this. And by being able to give back, it's an awesome experience on all levels, young or to old, and then those who are veterans. And it's an awesome experience just for me to get to see it as a civilian myself. So it's quite outstanding. And then again, there's a huge range of reactions that we get, but those are the most common. It's great to see.
Now, you fly other aircraft for the Collings Foundation as well?
Yes, sir. Right now, working on a type rating in the B-25, our twin engine, and also just do a lot of second-in-command on the 24, and then looking to start flying the 17 more regular. I mean, I'm still a fairly young pilot in general, but also for the foundation, so I'm still just trying to learn a lot of the aircraft. I mean, I've learned the Mustang, learning the B-25 right now, learning the B-24, getting ready to kind of dive even deeper into the B-17, and I'm trying to, you know, just be that all-around pilot that whenever something comes up, they can depend on me. And that honestly would be the ultimate goal, is to be able to fly all four of these different aircraft. It would just be an outstanding experience for me, and it's you know, it's fun. I want to learn this stuff and know what these young men were doing back in the war. And it's also just really awesome to be able to do this, especially at a young age, where I can still get around the airplanes, hop around on them like they did back then. And it's really neat. But yeah, I mean, that's what I'm doing, is flying these bombers and trying to get them all figured out, obviously, and also with the Mustang. So it's really neat to be able to have such a wide variety out here.
As a pilot, having flown all the aircraft that are here at least once or twice, what are the pros and cons as a pilot? What do you like and dislike, I guess, perhaps, about each airplane, if you think about it?
That'd be difficult. I mean, you know, some people, they can just kind of hop and go in a Cessna 172 and not necessarily have to do a whole bunch of homework, I guess. And I mean, obviously doing cross countries and stuff, you need to be doing your homework on that. But, you know, when it comes to this, there's so many systems on board, and there's just a lot of things to remember. I mean, heck, this is like, for example, and this is a very small example, like, you know, people are used to pushing the mixture up. Well, on the 17, on the 24, if you want to go rich, you actually have to pull the lever back. And those are just like, and that's just a very small detail. There's obviously a lot of other things that go along. Once you start diving more into the book, that you have to remember from aircraft to aircraft. And, you know, I mean, that's why you can't just hop in these things and go. It's a crew environment, which is actually one of the things I really like, is the crew atmosphere. You know, if I had to do this all by myself, I'd probably be overwhelmed and, you know, I wouldn't know what to do. But I mean, that's definitely one thing I like, is the crew atmosphere, especially on the bombers. But yeah, there's always those little things that you have to look for as well. And that's just, actually, it's not really an inconvenience. It's kind of part of the fun of learning the airplanes, really.
CRM is just as important to warbirds as it is with commercial aircraft.
Oh, yeah. I mean, hey, the airmanship and the crew activity that goes on with these airplanes is outstanding, especially out on here. I mean, you know, if we kind of have a – here out on this foundation, if you can't – you know, if you can't really get along, or if you just can't fly the airplane and be to the standard, it's kind of like, you know, well, we're going to have to use you somewhere else. But here it just takes – I'm working with outstanding pilots, guys that are able to pour into a young guy like me and give me a lot of experience just by talking to them. And that's one thing that's definitely enjoyable about this, because it's also it's fun but also enlightening. And with all the crew atmosphere that we have out here, there's a lot of bonding. And, I mean, it's probably similar to whenever you fly in the commercial airlines and whatnot, but this is obviously just a very unique, because it's – World War II bombers.
Jonathan, thank you so much for being a guest here with us on the Airplane Geeks.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
All right, Micah, thank you for those. Thank you for those. Now, we have a question. Micah sent in a question after listening to our conversation 2 weeks ago with Kelly Keller from Apario Systems when we were talking about ADS-B. And after that, Micah had an interesting question. Let's just listen to that.
Thanks, Max. Before I go any further, let me say how wonderful it was to hear Launchpad on episode 521 last week. Kelly Keller was a terrific guest, and learning a little bit more about Apario Systems and the Stratus was really interesting. But it brought up a question that I have that I'm hoping that, well, I'm guessing that Max West would be able to answer for me, and that is a little bit about ADS-B in to begin with. Now, I'm not a pilot, so I can't really speak from that perspective. But as a driver who uses GPS all the time, well, it's changed a little bit the way that I drive. In fact, it may have gotten me a bit lazier as a driver. Now, I have two GPS systems. I have a Garmin GPS mounted to the dash, and I also have the in-dash GPS. I use them both on and off, preferring the Garmin. But I'd find that I don't really look at maps so much anymore sometimes. I also don't quite pay as much attention as I used to where I'm going, as a GPS will usually take me. Now, I'm aware of it, and I always know whether I'm heading north, south, east, or west, have a general idea of where things are, but I'm pretty good geographically anyway, and always have a general idea of where I am on a map when looking at a map. But I'm wondering if ADS-B does the same for pilots. I'm wondering if having ADS-B in and looking at the aircraft around you changes the perception of pilots in terms of being alert and watching for traffic themselves. I know when I fly in the right-hand seat with friends, they've always asked me to keep an eye out onto the sky and look for other traffic. This was before the days of ADS-B, but I kept a sharp eye out and did what I could. So I'm wondering what you can tell me or what you think ADS-B might do. Will it make pilots lazier? I'm not talking about professional pilots necessarily. I'm talking about that general aviation pilot that goes out there maybe once or twice a month just to keep current. What do you think? Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you all later. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Well, Micah, no, I don't think that ADS-B is going to make pilots lazier. I think I would probably choose a different driving analogy than a GPS. I would say let's take a driver who has, poor eyesight. You know, they're perhaps nearsighted, and so they can't really see the cars around them, and maybe they're not even, particularly concerned because they can't see how many cars there actually are around them on the freeway. And then they get prescription glasses, and when they wear those, they've got 20/20 vision. Now they can suddenly see all the other cars around them. It makes them a better driver because they can see and avoid those cars. So I would say there are almost no downsides to using ADS-B in. probably the only downside I've seen is that if you're looking at the portable ADS-BN devices, which people can carry with them from plane to plane, those devices have a specific limitation, which is they're not going to see all the traffic. And so people can be misled by glancing at their iPad and go, oh, okay, I see the traffic and there's nothing here that affects me, when in fact there might be traffic there that affects you. And that's because in order to get a view of all the traffic that's around you, you have to be in an aircraft that's equipped with ADS-B out. And so if you're not in one of those airplanes, you might think you're seeing all the traffic, but you're not.
All right. Well, you know, the ADS-B episode has been one of the most popular episodes lately, at least maybe in the last few months. We had a huge interest in that topic. The download stats are very healthy there, so thanks to all who listened.
Okay, Max, he left us alone. You ready to do the news? Do you think we can handle this?
We're about to find out.
All right, well, our first story comes from the WashingtonPost.com. NTSB faults Air Canada pilots for last year's near disaster. Okay, last year's near disaster was what, Max?
Well, this happened in my backyard here at San Francisco when Air Canada Flight 759 nearly touched down on a runway, on a taxiway, which had four fully loaded aircraft waiting to depart. The NTSB had their final meeting in which they released their probable cause and recommendations. And they also gave more details about just how close this close call really was. And also, it's kind of interesting, there were some disconnects between what the crew kind of remembered versus what actually happened. In terms of how close it came, the crew said that they thought that they were about 400 feet above the taxiway when they initiated their go-around. Data shows actually that they were just 89 feet above the ground when they initiated the go-around, and that the airplane continued to descend to a minimum of altitude of 60 feet before it actually began to climb. And staff estimates, therefore, that Flight 79 was approximately 10 to 20 feet above the tails of the aircraft on the taxiway. So it just doesn't get any closer to that. I mean, if you do the math, literally, if they'd probably been a second later in initiating the go-around, this could have possibly been one of the largest disasters with hundreds and hundreds of people potentially killed. So it was actually the first time the NTSB investigated an incident that didn't involve an aircraft actually landing on the runway. In other words, they've never investigated a go-around before, but since this one was so incredibly close, they did. And so the NTSB determined that the probable cause of the incident was, quote, the flight crew's misidentification of taxiway Charlie as the intended landing runway, which resulted from the crew members' lack of awareness of the parallel runway closure due to their ineffective review of the NOTAMs, which was the information they got before the flight and during the approach briefing. Also contributing to the incident were the flight crew's failure to tune the ILS frequency for backup lateral guidance, which was required, expectation bias that they were looking at the correct runway, fatigue due to circadian disruption and length of continued wakefulness and breakdown in crew resource management. And they also said that Air Canada has had an ineffective presentation of approach procedures and NOTAM information. I watched the entire hearing over the web on Monday, the 25th, and 24th rather. And so one of the things I noticed was that the NOTAM system was really mentioned a lot by board members during the meeting. One of them said, quote, NOTAM system was really messed up. Another one said, and I wrote these down, another one said, only a software programmer would understand that his NOTAMs the way that they were written. And an NTSB staff member estimated that it would have taken the flight crew about 20 minutes to thoroughly read and understand all of the NOTAMs that were issued for Flight 759. Now, there was some discrepancies in terms of how many pages of NOTAMs they had to read through, but it was apparently at least 10 pages of NOTAMs. And the real problem was that almost all the information looked like it was of equal priority. So it was pretty hard to, instantly see that the runway was closed or to even then calculate the times because that runway closure actually occurred only about 2 hours before their arrival. So it had just happened.
Max, describe for some of us non-pilots, what's a NOTAM?
Oh, sure. Notice to airmen. So anytime there is some type of equipment that's out of service, such as a VOR, a navigational aid, anytime there's any type of a taxiway closure, a runway closure, anything that could affect a pilot flying a flight, those kinds of things get listed as NOTAMs. And I heard from a number of people after I posted a blog article about this, about how broken pilots view this system. It is a system that dates back, I'm guessing, well in excess of 60 years, and it's kind of like reading code. So it's not in plain English, and it requires a fair amount of deciphering. So it's a system, I think, that's really ripe for change and improvement.
I wonder if that will be one of the suggestions by the NTSB.
Absolutely.
I actually was going to ask you before you brought it up, because even I paid attention to the hostility that the board seemed to have towards that antiquated process, given that we are in the 21st century. And I don't know, it's sort of surprising in the amount of volumes of paper that these people had to read, or electronic paper, for one flight.
Yes, and I think the reason that the NOTAMs are still so cryptic is, this dates back to 60-plus years ago, when the method of transmitting all this stuff was the 64 baud teletype, and, these things would just kind of clunk out one character at a time. There wasn't a lot of bandwidth, and so they had to really come up with a condensed way of communicating as much information as possible with as few characters as possible. And I think everybody agrees we're well beyond the point where, things need to be communicated in that way.
It has always been done that way, unfortunately.
Yep, indeed. So there were a number of recommendations. One of the ones that was interesting, and I had not realized this until I watched the board hearing, was there was, of all the different approaches into San Francisco, all of them except one automatically tune the frequency that's going to be required for pilots to back up the approach and kind of electronically verify their proper guidance to the selected runway. The one that doesn't automatically tune the frequency is, of course, the one that this crew was using. That's the Quiet Bridge Visual Approach. It's a two-page description of how to fly that approach. And, of course, near the very end, it says that the ILS frequency must be tuned in. But it's an anomaly, because those frequencies get tuned in automatically for the crew for any other approach they fly. And so it wasn't really obvious to them that they had to manually tune in this frequency. Had they done that, then they would have had an electronic equipment telling them that they were off center for runway 28 right, and they might have caught their error that they'd lined up with the taxiway Charlie much sooner, and this wouldn't have been as close a call as it was.
Well, lessons learned, and luckily in this case, it wasn't a loss of life to cause the lessons learned. We'll move on to our next story. I found this one kind of interesting, Max, because given the other show, I had a meme pop up where someone showed a picture of an ultralight and with the comment, FAA says not required for registration to fly. And underneath it was a picture of a DJI Phantom quadcopter, and that said, must be registered with the FAA. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but this is the FAA approves an ultralight Vertol, and this was from abweb.com, a vertical takeoff and landing ultralight. That sounds kind of complicated.
Well, so apparently this is the first electric VTOL that's been approved for use in the United States. And it really caught my attention because it's from a company that I hadn't heard of in Watsonville, California, where I spend most weekends when I'm kind of relaxing and hanging out down that way. So it's called the Scorpion 3. It's about $150,000. They say they've already sold the first one to be used by the Dubai police. And this thing kind of looks like it's about the size of a four-wheel ATV, and somewhat similar configuration if instead of four wheels, you had a propeller on each of those corners of the device. So it's kind of like a quadcopter with pretty large propellers with a human being sitting right in the middle of all those propellers. And so I think that there are some problems with this particular design. One is, if there's some kind of problem, the pilot is going to go through a meat shredder, basically, with being surrounded by all these propellers. Hopefully they've come up with some way to mitigate that, though it's not obvious from looking at the picture. And, you know, certainly the quadcopters that I fly have a number of single points of failure. If one of the props, fails, or if one of the motors fails, or one of the electronic speed controls for the motors fails, those are three different points of failure for each of these different blades. So that's 12 single points of failure. If they haven't addressed this, then, to me, this looks like it'll fall out of the sky if any one of those things were to fail. Hopefully they've done a good job of building in some redundancy to this. Some of the comments from people who've posted on the article are kind of likewise skeptical of this. One of the persons likened it to the whirling blades of a Cuisinart blender. It remains to be seen, I think, exactly how safe these vehicles will be. And the reason, by the way, that no pilot license is required is because this has been certified in the ultralight category. And in the U.S., no pilot certificate is required for an ultralight aircraft, unlike Canada, for example, where if you're flying an ultralight, you do need a pilot certificate.
Do you have stick time in an ultralight?
No, I don't. Hmm. I had to think about that.
Well, he's got stick time in everything else, folks, but I was just sort of surprised. This week in FAA news, wrong show. This is from AIN Online also. The FAA got its reauthorization bill, sort of. The House passed it last week and the Senate passed it a one-week extension on Friday before it ran out on Monday today as we record this October 1st. So, Max, what do we have to look forward to? The Senate's kind of busy with other things right now, to be non-political, but so they don't really have time for an FAA authorization.
Well, I'll tell you what we have to look forward to, David. I think in a future show coming up pretty soon, we're going to be talking about some of the roughly 500 items that are thrown into this bill. I've glanced at it. It's 1,200 pages. It's going to require a fair amount of analysis to kind of pick out the interesting salient features of it. But you're right. The House passed it last week. The Senate was unable to vote on it prior to going into recess last week. So what they did, since funding was scheduled to run out this past weekend on September 30th, is they passed a one-week extension. And of course, we've talked about these extensions many times in the past. This is the so-called kicking the can down the road. And often these extensions are for periods of 6 months or something like that. In this particular case, the Senate passed a one-week extension, which was kind of surprising. And I checked on Twitter just a few minutes ago because this is kind of late-breaking news. And the Senate did vote late this afternoon, and we're talking right now on Monday, the 1st of October. The Senate did vote on the cloture process, and that basically is the process to essentially close out debate on the bill, which then starts a clock for several days before they can then actually vote. So it's quite possible the Senate will be voting later this week for the FAA reauthorization bill. Now, that's a five-year bill. They've also bundled some Hurricane Florence relief in it, over $1 billion, as I recall. So I think they're going to be highly motivated to pass this bill. And my guess is they'll probably be able to pass it, even in spite of all the other things that are going on there this week.
And we'll see. A lot of things. I believe, though, our biggest worry is they did take privatization out of the bill currently. If I'm correct on that, Max, right? They did that in the House version of it. They did take the privatization of ATC out.
Yeah, I did a fair amount of searching online on that a few days ago because one story caught my eye that suggested that maybe something like that had crept back in. But no, it appears that it has not crept back in. But, I think that we're going to see that come up again over and over and over again throughout our lifetimes, until they succeed in passing it. But yes, it looks like at this juncture that this particular bill will not split out air traffic control and privatize it as has been proposed so many times.
And of course, for us UAV fans, there is a lot of regulations about trying to speed up the FAA authorization process for UAVs and UAV operations. So we have that to look forward to. So this FAA authorization bill touches lots and lots of levels. It may sound like it's an easy thing, but it's 5 years, which is a good thing, but there is a grandiose scope to this, like my co-host here said. 1,200 pages is not a light read.
No, I think Congress basically threw in everything, including the kitchen sink. And so I'm sure that all the different inputs from their constituents kind of got rolled in together. And many of the legislators used this as an opportunity to put in their, you know, pet little project and directives toward the FAA. But hey, David, I got one for you. You ready?
Maybe.
Okay. I'm sure you caught this news. We've just had the first crash of an F-35, and to be specific, it's an F-35B. And also, I think I just read recently, we just had the first operational use of the aircraft in combat. So why don't you talk to us about both of those? And we've got stories here from the Washington Post and also from AvWeb.
It was kind of a big week for the F-35B. Now, for all of you who haven't had David Vanderhoof's primer on the F-35, there are three versions, the A, the B, and the C. The A, you could say, is the Air Force one, and that's the land version and the export version. It's the simplest of the three aircraft. The other one you can remember is the C, which stands for, quote-unquote, carrier, which is a aircraft that's got bigger wings. It has heftier landing gear, dual nose wheel, and the ability to launch from a catapult. So it's got a catapult bar. And that last but not least, if you remember, A is Air Force, C is carrier, which is the Navy. That leaves the B, which is the Marine one and the Royal Air Force one, as well as the Italian Air Force one. And that is the vertical takeoff and landing. It has the Rolls-Royce ducted fan besides the rotatable 90-degree engine. And it was a good week for the F-35, but there was also some bad news. The good news was the F-35B saw its first combat with the United States Marine Corps in Afghanistan. The other thing was the Royal Navy has parked their brand new carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, off of the coast of Pax River. Now, Pax River has a giant ski jump so that people can learn how to fly the aircraft off the ski jump, which is a way of getting the aircraft airborne quicker. It's used by the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force on the Invincible class carriers, as well as Queen Elizabeth now has a ski jump ramp. And the Royal Navy has been training on their F-35Bs at Pax River as well as down in Cherry Point, where they're learning how to operate the STOVL, short takeoff vertical landing version of the aircraft. The unfortunate news, though, besides the good news about the Royal Navy landing a aircraft on the aircraft carrier and the attacks in Afghanistan, was unfortunately, for the first time in 17 years of operation, it's hard to believe that we've been talking about F-35s for 17 years, but we had a Marine Corps aircraft. It went down on Friday, luckily, the Marine Corps pilot who was operating the aircraft did successfully eject out and was high enough that ejected with little to no injuries. So the squadron was belonged to VMFT 501. They're the responsible for training the Marines on the F-35B as well as the Royal Navy pilots. So, unfortunately, not a great day, a good week for the F-35 up until the catastrophic failure. But one aircraft in 17 years of testing operations, etc., is not a bad record if you look over time. So, but we'll see what the ramifications of what the causes were and whether it was pilot error or there was a catastrophic failure with the aircraft.
Okay. For general aviation accidents, I'm always looking at the trend lines. You know, not how many aircraft crash, but, you know, what is the rate at which they're crashing? And that's sometimes hard to calculate because you have to know how many total hours were were flown. And the good news is the actual rate has been trending down. So we're now actually below one fatal accident per 100,000 hours flown in general aviation. Now, I was surprised to see at the end of this Washington Post article a reference to the Military Times, which apparently found that mishaps are actually been rising steeply. Tell us about that.
I can give you a five-letter answer. M-O-N-E-Y.
I knew it. I was guessing that was it. Yep.
It wasn't that long ago we had sequestration. There's quite a few things going on with military operations. One is there is a revved up cycle now of going into deployment because we have eliminated a lot of aircraft and a lot of personnel due to cuts. So we've got a ramped up amount of aircraft going into combat, doing preps, but not enough really training for deployments. So you end up getting a negative repercussion, I guess would be the best way to describe it. We do have a pilot shortage in the military, just like we do in general aviation and airliners. And they are trying to work them up quicker to get them deployed because there's a very high attrition rate. And with all of those factors and money for spares and money for parts. For example, the Marine Corps, their F-18s, they have gone out to the boneyard and have been stripping aircraft from the boneyard in Davis-Monthan to keep their active duty aircraft flying. So all of those factors are involved. There's been a delay with the F-35 being deployed, there's been a delay. So we're flying aircraft longer than they were supposed to be. Originally the F-15C was designed to be flown for 20 years. That's it. That was that would have been 1995 if you assume that it was when it's production in 75. So you can imagine now we're pushing those well beyond their life to be, and all of those factors can contribute to more accidents and, unfortunately, more fatalities.
Yeah, and these numbers here said that Marine Corps aviation mishaps have jumped 80%, so almost doubled in 5 years. And they say similar trends in the Navy and the Air Force. So that's a little disconcerting. I mean, I think in general we like to see, when it comes to accident, trend lines that go down and to the right. This one, unfortunately, is headed in the wrong direction.
And the only way to do that is to provide better training, provide more money, and we'll see, and provide more modern equipment. My prime example of issues with aircraft is if you look at the Blue Angels over the last couple of years, they've had things like flaps fall off or slats fall off in the middle of demos because they are flying some of the oldest aircraft in the fleet and aren't going to get replacements for another 2 years plus. So those are the best, quote, the best of the best maintainers, you know, and if they're having issues keeping the aircraft flying, you know, you can imagine what the normal ground crews and grunts are doing what they need to do to keep their aircraft flying. And imagine keeping them flying in environments that are not necessarily conducive, like operating in the Middle East or outside of Afghanistan, or any sort of remote forward operating base. So we got the best crews in the world, but they're only as good as their equipment and their tools and their training.
Sure. If they're flying fewer hours per month, then that's got to lead to more accidents. And you're right about the Blue Angels. You know, when I was young, I don't remember hardly any accidents that I heard about in that time frame, and yet, you know, certainly we hear about more of them these days. So hopefully this gets turned around at some point in the future.
So, Max, we're podcasters, right? We do this for a living, right? Not.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to Max Flight. I'm going to try to get my salary doubled. I hope you do, too.
It's got way too many zeros.
Leading zeros.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to go there, but but you found an AA, and we're not talking Alcohol Anonymous podcast, did you?
Yeah, and I was kind of surprised. I would have thought that Brian Coleman would have been talking about this, and he's probably aware of it, but maybe not. I just heard about this indirectly on another podcast, a podcast about podcasts that I was listening to earlier today, and they talked about American Airlines podcasts that they use to reach their 122,000 employees as well as the public, which is kind of interesting. Years ago when I worked for Hewlett-Packard, we had cassette tapes that came out to the Salesforce, and that was a way for top management to communicate with us, but certainly they weren't releasing those to the public. So this certainly shows kind of more transparency than you might expect. The name of the podcast is Tell Me Why. It started earlier this year in 2018, has had a number of episodes out already. It can be found in all the places where you would find a podcast, such as the Apple Podcast app, formerly known as iTunes. And I've got to say, this particular article that I found when I went searching for it was about our favorite topic. And David, what's our favorite topic with airlines?
Leg room? Seat pitch?
No, four legs, David.
Oh, were you horsing around, or were we ponying up? Are we going to pony up this conversation?
Exactly. So this particular article talks about an episode in which they say the latest episode details the company's new stance on emotional support animals, a trend that the company says has skyrocketed in recent years, and goes on to say how flyers who want to bring their beloved squirrel, peacock, or mini horse will now have to provide a note 40 hours in advance. Wow, I didn't realize I could bring my squirrel with me. it seems like you really don't want a rodent on an airplane.
That's just nuts.
Yeah, I know. But when you think about what kind of animals gnaw wires, rodents, that's just, all right. So anyway, that's obviously.
Clearly the rats wouldn't be jumping ship ahead of everybody else, though.
No, at least not
on the airplane, because if they are, there's a real issue.
They would all be arriving at the same time, unfortunately. Yep. So anyway, that just happens to be randomly the one podcast episode that I'm familiar with based on this article that I pulled up. But I'm sure for folks who are really into airline travel and want to know all the latest and greatest information, this is probably a great idea. It makes me wonder if other airlines such as United or perhaps Southwest have podcasts as well. And if not, I would imagine that's going to be a trend because increasingly podcasts are used to communicate to people. And in the show that I heard, the podcast about podcasts, which is called the School of Broadcasting, when they talked about this earlier today, they talked about podcasts as a way for a company to really control the narrative. In the past, companies had to rely mostly on press releases. And then, of course, once they got out to journalists, they kind of lose control of message at that point. Journalists, would publish the entire press release. They would choose bits and pieces, and obviously it could be spun a little bit one way or the other. But I thought, that's an interesting point. This really becomes a way for a company to get their message out to their customers in the way that they would, like to convey themselves and communicate information. So anyway, I thought it was an interesting trend, and I'm sure we'll see more of this in the future.
And Mr. Trescott, the sign of a real geek is when you go out to listen to podcasts about podcasting while they talk about more podcasting, so you can listen to more podcasts. So you find that you don't have podcasts that you can't keep up with because you've got too many podcasts in your pod catcher.
And I think we've reached the point where it's time for us to throw it back to Max Flight. What do you say?
And away we go.
And hey, Max, thanks for letting us do the news.
Well, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Keith O'Brien, author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. We'll have links to where you can find the book, the website. Keith is on Twitter at KeithOB. You can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Be sure to visit airplanegeeks.com for show notes, including how to find us on social media, how to subscribe to the podcast, learn more about us, and you can even learn how to donate to help pay for all of this excitement. Show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/523. Now let's tell folks where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, you're up first.
You can find me on Twitter, if you can spell Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Facebook page. You can join Max and I and Max on our Slack listener team. You can do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings talking UAVs and drones with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAVDigest.com.
Great. And Max Trescott.
Well, you can find me everything related to aviationnewstalk.com. So either on the podcast or the website, click on contact on the website and you can send me an email. And also just want to mention that we have apps available that are free in the iPhone App Store and also in the Android to Google Play Store. So if you want to get notifications from me, for example, last week I sent out a notification when the NASA meeting about Air Canada 759 was live. So again, you can find all that stuff at aviationnewstalk.com.
Very good. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. Also, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, talking unmanned aircraft. And with Mary Kirby at PaxexPodcast.com. That's PaxexPodcast.com.
Oh, and Max, I just want to say this before you send us off. Thanks for trusting Mr. Trescott and I to do the news tonight. I know that you never often want to leave the ship, but in this case, thanks for letting us take control from you so you could go off and do important things. So thanks for your trust in us, and hopefully we didn't let you down.
Oh, I'm sure it will be fantastic, and thanks for letting me escape a little bit early to handle some things that need handling. So, well, we'll ask all of you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Brian, and I'm at Aviation Geek Fest with listener Matt. So I've come across someone truly special, and I'm sure longtime listeners of the show will recognize the voice immediately. Courtney, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. So getting back to the show, I was just wondering, there's been a bunch of there have been a bunch of co-hosts that have come and gone over the years. What do you think of how the show has evolved from what you and Max originally started?
Oh, it's trash. I mean, the problem is.
As the Southwest Pride of Texas flies overhead,
it's very appropriate.
All right, we're good.
Didn't know how to end it.
No, that's fine. Cut to something.